We're looking this morning at Ezekiel 8 through 11, really a tremendously interesting section of the book of Ezekiel. And this is, of course, where Ezekiel is taken in a vision, not in reality. He's not physically transported to Jerusalem, but in a vision, he is taken to the city and is able to see all the things that are going on there in the temple, things that are such egregious violations of the law of Moses. And it just really explains why God is so angry with the people, why the time has indeed come for judgment. So I'd like us to go ahead and just begin looking at this. We'll take a couple of class sessions to look at chapters 8 through 11. Let's start now with chapter 8. Let me just read most of this chapter here, and then we'll talk about it in detail. And it came about in the sixth year, on the fifth day of the sixth month, as I was sitting in the house with the elders of Judah sitting before me, that the hand of the Lord God fell on me there. Then I looked, and behold, a likeness as the appearance of a man. From his loins and downward, there was the appearance of fire. And from his loins and upward, the appearance of brightness, like the appearance of glowing metal. He stretched out the form of a hand and caught me by a lock of my head, and the Spirit lifted me up between earth and heaven and brought me in the visions of God to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy, which provokes to jealousy, was located. And behold, the glory of the God of Israel was there, like the appearance which I saw in the plain. Then he said to me, Son of man, raise your eyes now toward the north. So I raised my eyes toward the north, and behold, to the north of the altar gate was the idol of jealousy at the entrance. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what they are doing? The great abominations which the house of Israel are committing here, that I should be far from my sanctuary. But yet you will still see greater abominations. Then he brought me to the entrance of the court, and when I looked, and behold, a hole in the wall. And he said to me, Son of man, now dig through the wall. So I dug through the wall, and behold, an entrance. And he said to me, Go in and see the wicked abominations that are committed here. So I entered and looked, and behold, every form of creeping things and beasts and detestable things with all the idols of the house of Israel were carved on the wall all around. And standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel, with Jaazaniah the son of Shaphan standing among them, each man with his censer in his hand, and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. And he said to me, Son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark, each man in the room of his carved images? For they say, The Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken the land. And he said to me, Yet you will see still greater abominations which they are committing. Then he brought me to the entrance of the gate of the Lord's house, which was toward the north. And behold, the women were sitting there, weeping for Tammuz. And he said to me, Do you see this, son of man? Yet you will see still greater abominations than these. Then he brought me into the inner court of the Lord's house. And behold, at the entrance to the temple of the Lord, between the porch and the altar, were about 25 men with their backs to the temple of the Lord and their faces toward the east, and they were prostrating themselves eastward toward the sun. And he said to me, Do you see this, son of man? Is it too light a thing for the house of Judah to commit the abominations which they have committed here, that they have filled the land with violence and provoked me repeatedly? For behold, they are putting the twig to their nose. Therefore, I indeed shall deal in wrath. My eye will have no pity, nor shall I spare. And though they cry in my ears with a loud voice, yet I shall not listen to them. All right, now that's just the initial part of this visionary experience here. But we'll go ahead and just pause there. And let's look at the introduction here of all of this. You'll notice that now once again we have this vision dated, and we saw this back in chapter 1 where Ezekiel saw that initial vision of Yahweh's throne chariot and the four figures there, and the four faces and the wheel within a wheel, the four wheels within a wheel, and all of that. And this ultimately, as you see from the entire vision, all four of these chapters 8 through 11, it's the same warrior chariot here, okay? So it's the same kind of imagery here that he's seeing in this vision. But you'll notice that it's dated here to the sixth year on the fifth day of the sixth month. I don't know if you recall, but the first vision that he had back in chapter 1, that was in the, which year was it? The fifth year, okay, and in the fourth month. So basically what you've got is, this is now 14 months later, okay? And just by way of reminder, throughout the book of Ezekiel, he's always dating these visions, or not always, but most always, he is dating these visions. And it appears that he's always dating them. When he talks about the year here, he's talking about that year when King Jehoiachin and Ezekiel and that mass of exiles were taken away from Jerusalem into Babylonian exile. And so, as we've said, 593 BC would be the year according to our calendar year. And so this is now 14 months later. Now, just to make sure we kind of keep all this in our minds, during that period of time, in between his first visionary sighting of this warrior chariot throne of Yahweh and this incident here, what had Ezekiel been doing every day? What, Patty? Okay. Remember that whole incident where he had built that little model, so to speak, of Jerusalem under siege, and then he had lain on his left side for 390 days, and then on his right side for 40 days. And so this incident, now, if you just think about it, okay, this is 14 months later. This is sort of at the tail end of that daily routine that Ezekiel was engaging in. In fact, by this time, he is now laying on his right side, and if you recall the significance of that, when he was laying on his left side facing the north for 390 days, that was when he was bearing the burden, so to speak, in the vision. He's bearing the weight of the sins of Israel, the northern kingdom, and then for 40 days, when he was on his right side toward the south, that's in the direction of Judah, and so he's bearing the burden of the sins of Judah during that period of time. And so this is now toward the tail end of that, where he is, quite fittingly, now facing toward Judah, and he has this visionary experience of being taken to Jerusalem and seeing what the people of Judah are currently doing in the temple of Yahweh. So that's just to kind of help us get the setting of all of this. But you'll notice that verse 1 says that when this occurs, he was sitting in his house. Remember, he wasn't, you know, it wasn't 24 hours a day that he's lying on the ground out in public. There was just a period of time during each day when he would do that. Okay, so now he says, I was sitting in my house with the elders of Judah sitting before me. Now that's interesting. This won't be the only time the elders of Judah come to him. I don't think he means elders of Judah from back in Palestine. I think he's meaning the elders of the Judean exiles who were there among his community. before whom he is prophesying and performing all of these prophetic actions. So the elders of Judah now, they are sitting before him. And as I said, this won't be the only time that they actually come to him. And what do you think the point is? Why are these elders there? What would you be coming to this prophet Yahweh for? I think Caleb's just exactly right. You know, initially, I think all the people just thinking this guy's just crazy. He just lost his mind. But as all this keeps going on, and I think we also need to appreciate as the political situation between Babylonia and Judah is unfolding all during this period of time, has the Babylonian yoke on Judah and on its entire empire, has it shown any sign of releasing, of diminishing? No. If you know anything about the political situation at that period of time, Babylonia was as strong as ever. So, I think they are starting to come to Ezekiel, and they're questioning him as a prophet of God. And you see that certainly later on, as we keep going in the book of Ezekiel, where they're asking him questions as a prophet of God. He's starting to have some kind of an impact, or at least he's taken notice of by the elders among the exiled Jews there in Babylonia. And so it's on this occasion that and I think the point of this is that he has this vision, and ultimately he tells them about this. But this is when he has this vision, and it's another vision of this throne chair to God. But now he's taken in this vision to Jerusalem. So I want to look at that. You'll notice that you have this figure, and this is the same kind of figure that we saw back in the earlier vision. I think you've got representing an angelic being of God, and you know, that's what we saw in the very, very first vision. So this is God's angelic spokesman, or like an archangel that is speaking on behalf of Yahweh. So I want to go on now, but any question just about the introduction here? Yeah, Jerry? Exactly right.
They finally understood that one point. They haven't yet repented. So it's going to take a period of time before they finally comprehend through his prophecy that why they're in captivity.
And really, if you want to just kind of boil down the work of prophets in general, it's explaining their history to you. Why did what happened to our people? Why has it happened? That's really what the work of prophets. Yeah, they speak about future things, but I mean, really, they're explainers of their nation's history, and you see it going on. Ultimately, yeah, but as we'll see, it's going real strong right now. Did I overlook something? All right, well, let's just look at this now. Ezekiel is taken in this vision. Well, let's see. I don't want to say anything about this. Okay, well, just that the Spirit, kind of interesting how he does this, takes him by the lock of his head, lifts him up. And, you know, in this visionary experience, he's just carried to Jerusalem, to the entrance of the north gate of the inner court, where the seat of the idol of jealousy was located. Just sort of a depiction of the inner court, and I want to just kind of show you some things because to really appreciate what he's saying and where things are located, you need to understand a little bit about just how the temple, not just the sanctuary proper, but the entire temple complex was laid out. This is what we normally think of when we're thinking about the actual temple that Solomon had built. And, of course, outside of that temple, that's where you had the altar of burnt offering, and that's where the sacrifices were offered and all of that. But then that is all inside this inner court. And if you just look at this diagram here, okay, here's the sanctuary proper, there's the altar, here's this inner court area. And what Ezekiel is talking about is that in this vision, he is taken to this north side of the temple complex. And all of this area now is that complex of the temple. Here's the front of the temple. It was always facing east. Okay, that's how God had it built. That's how the tabernacle was always set up to always be facing east. And so you have the outer wall of the temple complex. Well, the text is talking about Ezekiel being taken here just outside the northern gate of this inner wall. And somewhere right out here, near that northern gate, there is, and this is the first of four things that God shows him, the first of four abominations that are going on in the temple area. And there's some idol, some detestable idol, and it's not described further. Obviously, the people of that day knew it very well. But here you have an idol, some kind of statue or idol to some kind of foreign deity that is right here in the temple of Yahweh itself. Now, if you think back about what the book of Kings talks about, all during the latter stage of Judah's history, when you had some of those very wicked kings, like, say, Manasseh, that's when they began to bring all sorts of idols into that temple area. Well, Josiah had removed all of those. And keep in mind that the current king, Jehoiachin, who's in exile with Ezekiel, he's one of the sons of King Josiah. And so Josiah, he had removed all of that in his reform effort. But what do we now see? You know, Josiah died in 609 B.C. And it's just almost like just apparently immediately after, you know, the people just revert back. Because Josiah wasn't able to really reform the people's hearts. They're still just as paganistic as they ever were in their thinking. And so here is Ezekiel, and the first thing he sees is some idolatrous statue, an abominable statue there. We don't know, you know, was it a, you know, stat, what god it was, but you can just imagine that kind of thing. And here it is in the temple of Yahweh. That's just right there at the gate area, everybody walking by, paying homage to this pagan god. You know, Solomon was criticized, and rightly so, for building shrines to his foreign wives for these pagan gods, but at least he put them on the, you know, Mount of Olives, east of the city, or in other hills, you know. And this is right here in the court area of Yahweh's house. I mean, it's just egregious, just this flagrant disregard of what the law of Moses said. So that's the first of these four abominations. Okay? Yeah, David. Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. We don't really know. There's not a lot of explanation about all of that. But that same description of Yahweh's glory above the war chariot that we saw back in the vision of chapters 1 through 4, it's that same vague way of referring to it. You know, whatever the glory of Yahweh means, is it just bright light, or, you know, something that would represent his glory? You know, we're not really told, but this glory of Yahweh that he had seen over the war chariot, well, okay, he sees it here in the temple area. And this is significant because ultimately, and not to get too far ahead of ourselves here, but ultimately, as we go through chapters 8, 9, 10, and 11, what does Ezekiel see about this glory of Yahweh? What does it ultimately do? It leaves. It leaves this defiled, abominable area. Okay? So that's really what we're seeing here, is that this is supposedly the house of Yahweh. This is supposed to be where his glory always dwells. And yet here he's having to dwell among all these pagan idols. So, you know, I don't know exactly where he is and, you know, exactly what Ezekiel's seeing, but, you know, it's the nature of him describing a vision. Who else raised their hand? Yeah, Jerry. In this inner court, this would have been the area where the priests would have been. Now, this outer court area is where the general population, according to the law of Moses, but, you know, how much was that being followed at this time? We don't know. I don't think so. I mean, you know, there were gates so you could go through, but yeah, this would have been the area where the priests would have entered into to then perform their sanctuary duties. But this abominable idol is outside the gate on the north side here. So it's in the area where all the people are. And I think that the point of this is this is where just the common people would be, but you know, who is, so to speak, guarding the entrance to Yahweh's temple? Well, it's this pagan god. You know, I think that's the point. And so all of the people of Judea who would be in this outer court area, that they're all seeing that, and I'm sure paying homage to that deity who was there. Okay? Yeah, Isaac. What we're going to see, exactly.
You know, that was the one thing. The other thing is a bit incredible. I don't want to throw us off because I'm famous for being that, but I'm just fascinated. What is it that draws the men of God, all of us, even us? What is it that we just gravitate away from God? We don't gravitate to God. And my question is it, do you think, as a teacher, as a professor, do you think it's the influence of the people around him? You know, the
certainly part. I think, yes, that's absolutely part of it. And we'll talk about this more as we keep on going, because I think the text gives us some indication of the very thing that would answer your question. But yeah, I think it's that, and I think it's the fact that, hey, well, you know, we've been praying to Yahweh here, and nothing's happened. Our exiles haven't come home. Well, then maybe we're worshiping the wrong God. I think that's exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. And now, what contributed to that? The surrounding nations? Absolutely. I think you see that throughout the book of Kings. You know, why did Ahaz, why did Manasseh come up with all these idols and a new altar to kind of put there and all that? It's because they saw it among the pagan temples.
It's the influence of evil that
eventually gives you. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, but I think this is important to see, and the fact that, well, when we do pray to God, when we do serve God, we don't get what we want. So then, let's just throw off him and let's try another God. I think that's exactly the which shows you about the attitude of the people. God's just sort of a genie figure, you know? Hey, you know, if he gives me what I want, great. But it's not really honoring him as God. That's not discussed here, so we don't, I mean, you know.
I mean, if there was one place where they probably wouldn't go, it would be there. There's probably they know still.
Maybe. Maybe they still remember some tales about, didn't somebody get killed when he touched the ark? You know, who was that? You know, and kind of talking about that, maybe. But as we keep going, that abomination isn't talked about here. So, but what Ezekiel is shown, is just there's enough, certainly more than enough to make up for all that. Okay, so then the text talks about, and let me just go back to this. Verse 7, where he talks, it says he takes him to the entrance of the court, and how does he actually get in this vision, how does he get into the inner court area? He has to dig a hole under there. Now, there were gates so that the priests could go through. But what's the point of, in the vision, God having him dig and go in privately, you know, without anyone seeing him, digging under the wall here and then seeing? Because what does he see next? He sees all these abominations that the elders of the people, the 70 elders, are engaged in secret. Okay, so now here are some things that they are doing secretly. But inside, where the common people wouldn't see, but Yahweh sees. And now he's having Ezekiel dig through so he can see. And when he digs through here on this northern wall and he looks in this area, in fact, maybe I'll just go to this picture here. I mean, you know, somewhere along this northern wall here is where we're talking about. Just adjacent, the text would indicate, to where the altar was. So here in this northern wall area. So he digs under there. And people ask, well, how could he do that? How could he dig through a wall? It's a vision. Okay? How did he travel all those, you know, 1,000 miles in a few minutes? Well, it's a vision. But the point is that when he then looks inside, what does he see all along the wall? In the inner court, where all the priests should be. In fact, the most holy of all the people of Judah should be. What does he see along all the walls? He sees images and inscriptions and engravings carved into the walls. And it's all sorts of creeping things and all these animals. And I think the point is, not that every one of them necessarily is an unclean animal, but a lot of them are. And what are all those images of animals doing there? They all represented in the ancient Near Eastern world what? Gods. So what are the people doing? Well, they're paying secret homage to these special gods, and keep on going with the text. He says, in verse 11, and standing in front of them were 70 elders of the house of Israel with Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan, standing among them, each man with a censer in his hand and the fragrance of the cloud of incense rising. Then he said to me, son of man, do you see what the elders of the house of Israel are committing in the dark? Each man in the room of his carved images. For they say, and this is the key, for they say, the Lord does not see us. The Lord has forsaken our land. Okay, several things here just to note. 70 elders of the people. So these are the leaders of the people. Does the figure of 70 elders, does that stand out in your mind as far as Old Testament history? When had God set up 70 elders of the people? Remember that? Yeah, way back in the book of Exodus and Numbers, and when they're in the wilderness, and Moses can't handle, you know, all of the issues that the people bring to him. And so what God allows him to do is to establish 70 elders who are then going to assist, and in fact, God's Spirit comes upon those 70 elders. All right? So, I mean, certainly this has to be an allusion back to all of that. Here's the irony of all of this. Okay, you think back about the 70 elders when the people of God were in the wilderness. Okay, here you have now, what's going on now? Well, they have 70 elders now, but guess what these 70 elders are doing? Here in the inner court of Yahweh's temple, well, they're secretly doing all their little magical arts and secret homages to all these other pagan gods. And why are they doing that? Because they say, Lord doesn't see us. He's forsaken us. This is the point I was making earlier. Well, we've been praying to Yahweh here, and the Babylonians are still holding us captive. We still got people who are holding us captive, and I mean, you know, things haven't gotten any better, so serving Yahweh hadn't done a single thing for us. Maybe some of these other gods can help us. So this is what the leaders of the people are engaged in. Now, there's also another factor. You know, the text doesn't specify all of this. But these 70 elders, you know, the 70 elders, leaders of the people, wouldn't have all, at least normally, wouldn't have all been from the tribe of Levi, wouldn't have all been priests. So it may be that part of what's going on here is that you have even a violation of the sanctity of this part of the sanctuary area by even non-priests who are being there, much less than what they're doing there. And you'll notice the text says that each one has their own room, or the Hebrew word can maybe, their own space. So it's almost like this is just a routine thing. You know, this is their own spot, and this is where they do their little secret homages to these various gods, because maybe those gods can help us, because Yahweh isn't doing a thing for us. He didn't see us. And one of them is even mentioned, Jaazaniah, the son of Shaphan. Obviously, the reason why he's mentioned by name is that the fact that he's the one who is involved in all this is sort of especially telling and astounding. Usually, it's thought that maybe the reason is this. The Book of Kings tells us that during the reign of Josiah, okay, just the previous generation, Shaphan was the high official under Josiah's kingship. And so maybe this is the son of that very individual. Which, if so, just sort of highlights just how degraded the people had become and so quickly. Now, whether that's the Shaphan the text is talking about, we can't be 100% sure, but obviously he's named because there's something about this individual that really stands out. And that would certainly make sense. All right, question or comment about any of that? Okay. Then, yeah.
In the darkness, that's not, I mean, basically it's just saying it's private, right? Not necessarily in a dark, closed-in area.
You know, I mean, I think it certainly could be that, though we don't know enough about some of these pagan rituals to even maybe know what they might, how they might have conducted. But I don't know that it has to mean actually, you know, in the darkness of night or something. But just
bring that up is because it says then the Lord does not see us. Almost like they're saying we're in a place where God can't see us.
Yeah.
These detestable things and God doesn't see it.
You could take that statement, God does not see us, in two ways. You could take it as, okay, we're doing this and God can't tell that we're doing this.
Right.
But the parallel, you know, the next comment makes me think that it's really the second point, that, you know, we've been praying to God and he doesn't see us at all. He doesn't see our predicament. He isn't helping us. He has forsaken us. So I think that's probably really more what they mean. But, I mean, I think if you asked them, they would say, well, Yahweh, he's just left this area, or we don't know where he is. So maybe they are thinking he doesn't actually see what's going on. But I think it's still in the context of because he doesn't care. Yeah, let me get Jerry first and then.
The burning of the incense being totally limited to the priest, but the elders now are burning that incense. Could we use that as an example that while they thought they were worshiping God, in reality, if we did that today, looking at the people, there's only one way to worship God, and we see all these various ways that people think they're doing.
All of this is talking about that.
God doesn't accept it.
I mean, you just cannot read the Old Testament and come away with the idea that God doesn't really care how you go about worship, or the actual form of worship is irrelevant. Now, you also couldn't read the Old Testament, and especially read the prophets, and come away thinking that, well, if the form is okay, your heart doesn't have to be right, and God's fine with that. Now, you certainly wouldn't get that idea either. But you certainly would not, as you say, get the idea that, you know, God doesn't really care how you do it. If you violate what he says to do, that's fine with him. The whole point of this is that everything here is a violation of what the law of Moses had said, what Yahweh said was to be done at his sanctuary. Okay. Agnes? Okay, yeah. And the answer to that question is, nobody knows. In Oregon. They obviously knew very well what that meant. But the usual thought is this must be something that was part of the ritual to pagan deities. And, you know, if people speculate, and that's all we're doing is speculating. Some people even think maybe the text is a little corrupt there and that maybe it's talking about something else. But it would seem to be talking about, in some way, putting the branch to their nose, smelling some fragrant, some fragrance. Maybe, again, we're speculating, it's a ritual that is connected with what we're fixing to see as we keep on going with it. The whole Asherah worship and Oh, I think they absolutely knew what it was, you know. Well, let me hurry on here. So, what's the next thing that he sees there inside the inner court at the gate before the altar? Okay, actually probably off of this picture here, but at that gate there, what does he see women doing? They're weeping for Tammuz, and Tammuz was a Babylonian god. The Babylonian god later after this time, it would sort of evolve in the Greek period into Adonis and Aphrodite worship. Okay, we're maybe more familiar with those names. But this was actually a kind of god that was associated with fertility and the passing of the seasons and the crops and everything. And as I said, it originated in ancient Babylon, actually ancient Sumer. Dumuzi was their way of originally pronouncing that, and so now it's Tammuz. But this is a god in their mythology. They would speak about the changing of the seasons, and so now you've got in the fall and the winter seasons, Tammuz, they spoke of that as him dying. And then Ishtar, the female deity, she would then call upon him to come back. And even there's some indication, even maybe the concept was, a little uncertain, but maybe the concept was that Tammuz was then resurrected. And that's what was symbolizing what happens when springtime returns and the plants bud and the crops grow and all that stuff. And so that's this whole cycle. And so part of their ritual was that the women would weep for the demise or maybe even the actual death of Tammuz as the season would finally head toward the wintertime. And the whole point of that is if we weep and we call upon Ishtar, then he will hopefully come back to life or be restored next year and our crops will grow. What's going on in Yahweh's temple? Okay. All these women are engaging in Tammuz worship like the pagans do. Yeah, the women of Judea ought to be crying, but who should they be crying and weeping and praying to about all this? Yahweh. Yahweh's the one that causes the seasons to pass. and the springtime to return all this. It's not this pagan deity. But this is what's going on. And each time Ezekiel says, yeah, this is just terrible, but guess what? It gets even worse. What's the fourth and final one? We got to quickly say this. He sees here in this area here, he sees 25 of the leaders of the people. They're all bowing down toward the east. What's the significance of that? They're worshiping the sun. They're sun worshipers. That's what the Egyptians did. Remember, at this time, the whole issue is, well, are we going to cater to the Babylonians, or are we going to cater to Egypt? Because Egypt might be able to defeat the Babylonians next time they come around. And so that was the big political issue. So maybe the point of this, you've got some people among the people of Judah, they're catering to Babylonian deities. You've got others who are now worshiping the sun like the Egyptians. It's all right here in the temple of Yahweh. And so, well, I got it. I don't have time to talk about all this. But we will talk about all this, chapters 9 through 11, Wednesday night. But Yahweh just, in this vision, he just sends his angels to just go wreak havoc and to bring judgment on all of this. And we'll see the glory of Yahweh leaves this area. So, just a really tragic, tragic thing. Tommy? Okay, this is now the 6th century B.C. Isaiah was an 8th century prophet. So he prophesied in the latter half of the 8th century. So, you know, you're talking two centuries later. This is now the latter portion.
In Isaiah
44. Or this is like 150 years. Oh, yeah.
Wood.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. Really, really. Right.
I wanted to get back to what Isaac was saying about why the just a generation later. I think it has something to do with the inner man, the progressive attitude, which it can be good. Technology building upon prior stuff, but it can be bad, especially when it comes to religion, because they think they can do things better than prior generations.
Yeah.
When God doesn't want it better, he wants it the way to be established.
I think you're right, and again, though, I think we need to appreciate what the text is saying, is why are the people doing this? Because Yahweh's forsaken us. Had Yahweh forsaken them? They have forsaken him. Now, I mean, what do they mean by that? Guess what? It's the same thing people in our day say. Why'd you quit coming to church? I don't get anything out of it. Serving God doesn't help me. That's what these people were saying. And so they were going for something else. Maybe some other god. Maybe some superstition that the Babylonians had or the Egyptians had. That's what these people were doing. Our people in our day did the same thing. Same thing. Okay. All right. We'll stop there and then go through the rest of all this in Wednesday night. Make sure, though, read once again chapters 8 through 11 so that Wednesday night you see that whole big picture. That'll help us. All right. Thank you, folks.